Ladies and gentlemen, today on the podcast, I have Mike Corcion, right?
That's
So,
correct. On the money.
Corcion, aka Corky Gunn, the former lead singer of the band Sweet Pain, road managed LA Guns, and he wrote the book Tales from the Gutter. So, Mr. Corcion, welcome to the Hair Metal Rules podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on here. My name's Jeremy, by the way.
Yes, Jeremy. Well, thank you for inviting me on. I appreciate it always to, meet some new people, tell some stories, and talk a little bit about music in the 80s or whatever people really want to hear about. But yeah, I've done a lot of different things in my life in music, and I've experienced a lot in that time period, 70s, 80s, 90s, which is the golden age of, the rock scene, I guess. I mean, the 60s, yes, the 60s was the it was where it really started exploding. But I was born in 1960, so I experienced music in the 60s through relatives or friend or
Right.
parents or AM radio and 45 singles. And so I was always a song guy. I love
Right.
good song, no matter what the genre. So that's really, my exposure to that. But by the time I was a teenager in the 70s, I mean, I'm going to concerts and stuff. So, my very first concert, real quick, I was born in New York, but my parents divorced when I was 12, going into 13. And so then my mom moved back to her hometown in Georgia with all the
Okay.
kids. So she grew up in Georgia. So my first concert when I was living there for the I was in Georgia for about 5 years, but my first concert was Lynyrd Skynyrd, 1974, Columbus, Georgia. I was 13, going on 14. So I the concerts then. I mean, how old are you?
I'm 53.
Okay, so you're about 10 years younger than me. So
Yeah.
concerts then, even in the 80s, concerts were. It was like going to church almost. It was like a
Right.
communal, it was where people met each other and interacted. There's no social media and internet. Everything was in person. So same reason nightclubs and bar bands had, I mean, once I moved back to New York in 1978 and I started going to see Twisted Sister in clubs and bars. I mean, but these clubs held, 3,000 people.
Right.
Massive places. So it was that's what you did, when the boys wanted to meet girls, girls wanted to meet the guys, and the crazy people wanted to meet the drug dealers, you went out to clubs. I mean, that's what went on. So it's just younger people have a fascination with that period because it's not that way anymore.
See and play, but the 80s was the greatest time to grow up, in my opinion, for music.
Yeah, I mean the 80s were the baby of what came in the 70s in a sense. So in the 70s it was that's when the business of the music and record business really kicked into overdrive in the 70s. In the 60s, he was still figuring it out. It was like, the industry was there, but it was a lot of these labels didn't know what to make of the hippie scene and all this stuff. So you come into the 70s from the 60s, and the business had they figured it out. Payola was always in the business, paying people to get bands on the radio or whatever. What did you have in the 70s? The big scene out of the 70s really was soft rock and John Denver kind of stuff and
Right.
Seals and Crofts and all this stuff. But then you had the Zeppelins and the beginnings of Queen and all these bands started happening. Kiss, of course, Aerosmith, all these bands started happening in the 70s. By the time you got to the 80s, it was like a formula in a sense. LA, I mean, Van Halen came out of LA in the late 70s.
Right.
That was that really kind of set the tone in a way. So, but there was a big gap between Van Halen starting in, say, 77 and the beginnings of what would be Motley Crue or Rat or all that stuff was, you know, 81, you know, you're talking a gap there where it was like Van Halen was just everything. And, you know, if you follow what a lot of the, I mean, if you follow what Nikki Sixx says, he was saying that Motley Crue was a reaction against New Wave and the Knack and Skinny Ties and all that stuff. So they were trying to bring that back. But you know, you had had Y&T and all these other bands that were before Motley Crue that was still, that was still in the mix a little bit, the beginnings of, you know, the early Quiet Riot and all this stuff. Once you got to Motley Crue in 82 and Ozzy was getting huge. I mean, again, Ozzy had nothing to do with the Sunset Strip, but, but, you know, put it this way. Also influential thing was the radio stations out in LA at that time. Whereas in New York, they're playing, there's disco stations and new wave stations. In LA and that whole valley and that whole Southern California scene, there were stations that were playing metal, glam metal and stuff, where they weren't playing that in New York, but they were playing it out there. So you had a base for a band to get on the radio locally and start building something. Different time, the business was structured different. But yes, once it all exploded, once Motley Crue and Rat really hit, and that was it, man. It was like the floodgates opened up, and then bands moved there or wanted to move there, or local bands got bigger. But you know, it was I was out there. I mean, the first time I was out in LA was I think 84 from New York. I went out there to mix the Sweet Pain record, actually. But once I started working for LA Guns in late 87, and I was hanging with those guys all through 87, it, you know, it was already, you know, Guns N' Roses was just had started and was starting to really make noise. And it was just, you know, it was just LA Guns were a good band, but they kind of came at the end, really. The golden time to really make it in the LA scene was the 82 to like 85, 86 in there. Once you got past those years, it was a formula and it was burning out, and that opened it up to the grunge world. And you know, but but that period out there was, again, like you had said earlier, no one was looking to get in trouble and start, people just wanted to have a good time. And there was, it was so, you know, put it this way, I've been around sleazy people and sleazy bars and clubs and stuff my whole life, growing up as a DJ in a nightclubs when I was a teenager. So, but out there, it's like, you know, the sleaze factor, because it's Hollywood and Los Angeles is just like the there's, it's really, you know, it's like, and it still goes on. It's just not in the metal scene. Or the glam rock scene. But yeah, it was a crazy time. I mean, it was, you know, but again, what made that crazy? What made the days of disco in New York and Studio 54 crazy? But because there was no cell phones and internet and social media. You had to go interact with other people in order to find music, culture, art, whatever, sex, drugs, rock and roll. You had to go out. And that's why the clubs were so important. Was like a breeding ground for all this stuff. Yeah, you mentioned the Flaming Mug. I mean, that was a everybody that came through North Carolina played the Flaming Mug. So, but there was a Flaming Mug in every city. You know what I mean? So it was it was bands could survive. There were places to play, and they were selling out clubs. LA Guns at their peak, to me, of that whole first album and everything. You know, when you're playing a club, a big club in Chicago, two nights in a row and selling it out, that's what is missing today. Today, today, either you're nothing or you're positioned to be like a super celebrity and play the Super Bowl or something. There's no in between anymore, where selling out two nights at the Thirsty Whale in Chicago was like, you know, that was a, it was a big deal for the energy of the movement when you do those kind of things. It's like, yes, you make money and we sold it out or whatever, but like there's an energy in the room. And again, no one was doing this. You know, this was
right. Yes.
People were looking at the stage and feeling the band. It was a different world. I mean, you know, it's just sad it doesn't exist. But I wrote in my, I don't know where I wrote somewhere. Either it's in my book or it's somewhere on my Instagram. Somebody had said, I think it's in my book, actually. It's like the scene that we grew up in New York, the great Gildersleeve's club in the Lower East Side and New York, that rock scene in the late 70s. It was so cool and so great, and it's gone and never come back. It's like, you know, vaudeville or something. Like you'll never see it again. And that's how I feel about rock in general. It's like vaudeville. It's like a, you know, you'll never see it again, except like you said, it's left on YouTube and stuff. So
I think you're exactly right in what you say. I was talking to somebody not long ago. I mean, a band, in today's world, you can have four band members in four separate parts of the country recording, send it all to one another and make an album and never physically lay eyes on one another or be in the same room with one another. And that's how things get done today. And you can, like you said, you can post something on Instagram or YouTube or whatever, and 10 million people see it in 30 seconds, if that's as far as it goes. I talked to folks that recorded in studios back in the day, and they said it was so much more of an enjoyable experience to actually everybody pack in a room and crank something out. And, okay, that doesn't sound quite right. Let's redo that. He's right there. Instead of having, okay, I'm going to redo this file. I'm going to email it to you. I think music nowadays, I don't listen to new music. I'm not ashamed to say it. I'm stuck in the 80s. I enjoy hair metal, glam metal. You know, I love Rocks Gang. I love LA Guns. I love Shotgun Messiah. I was always drawn to the more obscure bands than the ones that the Motley Crues, the Rats, the Dawkins. I loved the, you know, the Lillian Axes, the Heaven's Edges. You know, I enjoyed bands like that. But you're right. I don't listen to new music nowadays. The closest thing I've ever come to listening to new music is my daughter's 25, and for the last few years, she's really liked the band Ghost. You know, and I enjoy some of their music because some of their music sounds like 80s type music. But you know, you're right. I think it would have ruined things if everybody would have had a cell phone recording every minute of the 80s. Now you just see some raw footage. Somebody had a handheld camcorder, you know, videotaping someone at Grisari's or you know, the Whiskey Go-Go. It makes it a little bit more interesting and to watch it.
The thing is there, though, also, is that the people that were there, it's like the technology didn't exist, so they couldn't have had the temptation to do it. You know what I mean? If it existed then, people would have used it just like they use it today. So, you know, it's like, that's why my Instagram photos and everything were so interesting to people, because I have a lot of photos that were very candid photos, but, you know, if there would be no need to put them on Instagram today, if it was happening right now, because it would be in real time and no one would care. Sure. So the fact that I have the photos is what makes them interesting. So, you know, yes, it was not a concern that people were, you know, everybody is trying to be heard today. And, you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't be, but what that does is it eliminates any real, JJ French from Twisted Sister, I just read an article he did for some guitar magazine or something. He was talking about why rock is dead, and he laid it out really well. When he was a young person going to see, Jimi Hendrix at the Fillmore East, all those rock stars in that period were 27, 26, 25. They were in your age range, you know what I mean? Today, there's no new rock star. Everybody, all the rock people are 80 years old. So it's just like there's no new people coming, no new bands coming along to take their place. So it's just like it was such a time capsule. And that's why you enjoy it. And so many people enjoy the 80s and the 70s. And then there's people that really enjoy the vibe of the 90s, whatever. They enjoy it because there's a time capsule that'll never happen again. It's gone like the wind.
Right,
You'll never
right.
see it, never happen again, and there's nothing taking its place. So, that's why I always say the golden period of American music was between 1920, really, and about the year 2000. That's it, 80 years of great stuff. I rarely listen to any rock, really. I listen to all kinds of stuff, but if I do listen to rock music, I always find myself going back to the same records I always loved because they're great. There's a reason they're great and they still sound great. They were making the music for different reasons, to express themselves, connect with people. Sure, everybody wanted to make money and be famous or whatever, but that wasn't what drove those early bands, 70s, 80s. It was about connecting with people and having people sing your song back to you and all that kind of stuff. It was about emotion. The yes, everybody wanted money and groupies and all that stuff, but once bands started losing sight of that, and all they wanted were the groupies and the money and the celebrity, that's when it all. Then you had bands like Nirvana coming around that were like anti all of that, and there you go. So it kind of ate itself, that scene. But for the, and again, the 80s, I was working as a DJ in New York a lot in the 80s, and it was very new wave driven, and Duran Duran and The Cure and all those bands. And the 80s were big from Def Leppard, Motley Crue, and Rat to, Michael Jackson and Cyndi Lauper and Prince. And I mean, it was a lot going on in the 80s. It was a very unique decade musically, and scene wise. It was a great time. I had been friends and gotten friendly from my high school days in New York with Bruno Ravel, who's in Danger Danger, who formed Danger Danger. So me and Bruno go back to being teenagers. So he was in a cover band in like 83, 1983. He was in a cover band in New York called Hotshot that did all the new wave songs. Him and Steve West, who formed Danger Danger, were in that band. So they did new wave songs and Duran Duran, and they played all the bars around the New York area. Kelly Nichols became their roadie. And I was friendly with Bruno, and I was always going to see them play. So I got friendly with Kelly when he started working for Hotshot. He was the roadie, and we just immediately connected, and we just would, got really friendly. We just, liked each other. So we had lots of fun. I was working for the record distributor. Important record distributors who later started the record labels Relativity and Combat Records. So I was working for them, and they asked me, the owner of the distributor and the label Combat said I should, they wanted a glam band. He's like, you should just start a band. And I had never wanted to had any intention of being in a band. And I got Kelly Nichols in right away, and he could barely play bass. So it was a real, almost punk rock kind of approach to the whole thing. And that's how Kelly got going. And then he ended up in LA and joined Faster Pussycat. And then he got into a bad motorcycle accident and really hurt his leg. And he had to drop out of Faster Pussycat. And then Tracy Guns asked him to join LA Guns. Actually, the first time I ever saw LA Guns play was at the Troubadour, and Kelly was still on crutches. Like he was like he couldn't move. He had to just stand in place because his leg was really bad. But yeah, I mean, I know Kelly from those days. I mean, we used to just, you know, but again, there was a scene of bars that had bands. So you had cover bands, you had, you know, hard rock metal cover bands, you had new wave cover bands, you had, you know, soul disco cover bands, and they would go and play bars and play the hits. And there was a th that scene bred a lot of, I'll tell you who else came out of that Long Island cover band scene is Bobby Rondinelli. You know who he is? The drummer in Rainbow.
Oh,
That
yeah.
was Rainbow through Surrender and Stone Cold and all those songs with Joe Lynn Turner. He was in a cover band out in Long Island. Tony Bruno, who was in Soraya, he came out of that scene. So
Okay.
the cover band scene was like, you know, if you had, you know, desire to go further than that, it gave you like a launching pad. You could work as a musician, get paid, meet people, mingle, you know, and it's just, then you could just weave through it all. If you were talented, you'd always have work. So that's what's missing is the bar scene, the club scene. It's just like, you know, every town. LA Guns first tour was all clubs that first
Wow.
year. And I mean, they opened for people in arenas, but you get started in the clubs, and every city had clubs, and you just, that's what it was all about. But you know, it's all gone, all those places. It's just like, it's like vaudeville. You'll never see it again.
There's no bars, you know, but you made a good point. The bands that are still out there playing are 60 years old. They're getting close to 70 years old. But I think it's great that they're still out there playing music. There's like me and my wife, we're going to M3 this year. We go to M3 every year. And you know, you get to see the bands from the 80s play. It may only be one original member that's out there playing, but they're not out there promoting something new they did. They're going out there and playing a whole set of the best songs they had from the 80s. And the place is packed. There's still a market for it, and I'm very glad these guys still play. I never saw LA Guns play before, but we did see Riley's LA Guns, that version of LA Guns, which is you made what just a couple of the original members of LA Guns. But when I first saw LA Guns, I saw them on the Headbangers Ball, and I thought LA Guns was one of the coolest, hard driving, raw, nasty sounding bands when their debut album came out. I've always been a big LA Guns fan.
Yeah, they when I first saw that band was in the, I think the summer of 87. They had a different drummer at the time. Steve Riley hadn't joined yet, but LA
Right.
Guns has a long history. They, you know, they started out as like a straight metal sound in 84. And then they evolved, and you know, Axl was in the band for a second, and then this happened and that happened, and then they had guys like Robert Stoddard that no one ever talks about, and other people in the band that they were like a punkish hard rock kind of a band. They were very close sounding to like the Lords of the New Church, but like a little heavier. They had a different kind of an influence because they weren't playing Gazaris. They weren't playing all the metal places. They were trying to play, you know, Scream and all these like alternative leaning places where, you know, the Cult might play or those kind of bands. So it was not, they weren't trying to play Gazaris. They weren't trying to be Poison and all that kind of stuff. You know, so they were trying to be darker, more British vibe, you know, new wavy, punkish, you know, and then Tracy. You know, even on that first album, Tracy's a, you know, I used to say Tracy was a metal guitarist, but Tracy's a good guitar player. He gets bored easily, and he likes to change and jump around and do stuff. But at that time, they were really good. They had a great vibe. They had a great sound. They weren't metal. They weren't punk, you know, it was hard to figure out. The only thing that made you think that they might be metal was maybe, I don't know, some of the clothes in the, you know, back right. cover of the album, you know. But yeah. again, and then you'd see videos. But that whole first year of 88, they were, that was the true, you know. And once Phil Lewis joined the band in 87, and he's British, so it gave them a different edge. They really had a unique thing. So then you get into Cocked and Loaded. So in 89, they get rid of their manager, their booking agent. They fired everybody, and they wanted to be bigger and better and more famous because, see, that's the bug that bites you. All of a sudden, you know, you had a good first year, the record company's behind you, and then everybody starts telling you, well, you need a radio song, and you need to start writing with this guy, and you need to do this, and that's what they did. They, you know, Cocked and Loaded, I'm not saying it's a bad record, but it's not really... it's not really LA Guns. There's other writers on it. It's like try too hard to be, instead of just going up a step, they wanted to go up like 10 steps. You know, they tried too hard to me, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, they took out their own tour with opening bands. And, you know, you go out on the road as a headliner with two opening bands and production and staging and trucks, and you can't make money. You're going to lose money. You know, that was, to me, a wrong move. They should have just kept doing clubs and doing what they were doing and jumping on. At that point, they could have opened up for a lot of tours, probably.
Right, yeah.
But they wanted to be, they had their own production. I mean, so, and then once all that, once you got past Cocked and Loaded, that was kind of like, you know, by the time you got to Hollywood Vampires, the year Hollywood Vampires came out, so did Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, all that stuff came out in 91. Chili Peppers, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, 91, all that stuff came out. So Hollywood Vampires didn't stand a chance. But it was, you know, that first year and that first album was great. They were a really hungry, I mean, great live band. They blast your face off, whether they were opening for AC/DC or in a club. They were tight, and they had a vibe. And that sounds like, you know, to me, because people define LA Guns by that lineup on that first couple records. That first LA Guns album is the sound of LA Guns to me. Sex Action, Electric Gypsy, One More Reason.
Oh, yeah.
Just slamming, you rip your face off, you know. And
their first album to their second album, it was a total different sound of music. In my opinion, it wasn't quite as hard, it wasn't quite as edgy, and a lot of bands were like that. You go Cinderella's first album, and then you go to the album after that, their blues influence came into play. And that's what they wanted to do initially. But I think if you hadn't had that Mike Songs album or that first LA Guns album and get people hooked, I don't think you would have really had a following after that. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. You know, musicians get bored, you know. Right. I mean, in the case of Cinderella, I mean, and I don't know anything about the business of Cinderella, but mm-hmm. I was very plugged into that world, and I knew what was going on in the scene. So with that album you're talking about, I think is Long Cold Winter.
Yes, so, their second album.
So, yeah. You know, he, following the Bon Jovi lead of Young Guns and all that kind of, they, mm-hmm. you know, wanting to be, we're not metal, we want to be more blues rock, like an Aerosmith or something from the old Aerosmith days. And that's where that came from. But the band that came along and leveled the playing field and made that who they were, because that is who they were, is Guns N' Roses. I mean, when Guns N' Roses came out, anything glam, metal, cherry pie, whatever, none of that mattered anymore, because Guns N' Roses was the real deal street band, guys that were heroin addicts or heroin dealers or getting arrested, and those guys were the real deal. And they captured magic in that first album. So, right. But that's what Kiefer was trying to do, I think, because Bon Jovi had gone that route with Blaze of Glory and, you know, more cowboy and more blues and more. Everybody's trying to get back to the roots and get away from matching leather outfits and cherry pie. So it was kind of like, you know, and Kiefer is a good musician and a true musician. So he probably felt captured in that world of, and he's like, no. And, you know, and that record did pretty good. Was it Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone? That was the big ballad on that album.
Yes.
But yes, in those days, if you didn't have a ballad, no one at the record company would even listen to you. You had to have a ballad.
But it's funny that the bands that had the super debut albums, and then went in kind of a different direction after that. But, you know, you never saw a Rat do that. When you got a Rat album, it doesn't matter if it was Out of the Cellar, Invasion of Your Privacy, Dancing Undercover, it was Rat. You knew you were going to get, and this is just my opinion, but you knew you were going to get a typical Rat album with great hooks, great guitars. Same thing with Dokken. You knew when the Dokken album came out, it was going to be in the vein of the rest of Dokken. They never really changed at all. Rat never really changed at all through their albums. Keel was a band that never changed. I mean, Keel was never a huge band, but they had albums. They never changed, but you get Night Songs, and then you get Long Cold Winter. You get Skid Row's first album, which was great, and then you get Slave to the Grind, which they went berserk on that album, and it was 10 times heavier than the first album. But it's, you know, I think a lot of the bands, but it's like you said too, towards the end of the 80s, you start looking at the dates on the back of albums or CDs that I was huge fans of. And you're exactly right. It was 1989. It was the very end of it. And if they would have been 3 or 4 years earlier, they would probably, some of these bands would have been 10 times huger than they were. But you had so many bands that looked just alike one another along that time too. And it, you know, there was really not a lot of diversity in some of the sounds that some of these bands had.
Yeah. I mean, you know, by the time you got to, you know, Warrant and all that stuff, I mean, I hate to pick on Warrant, but like that was the beginning of the end to me, because it was like, yeah, you know, they were a good band, talented, wrote good songs. No, we're not questioning their musical ability. Right. Or their songwriting, but you know, the matching leather outfits and all that stuff became, yeah, because if you know anything, I knew people in the record business, so you know, you hear the stories of what they're talking about up at Columbia, you know, it's like 1 minute there's the Heaven video, mm-hmm, is a priority, and the next day, snap of a finger, you know, it's Alice in Chains or whatever. That's that, but that's the fickle nature of the record business. But that became almost like, I don't know, and I don't even know what year that was. That's the Heaven video, Warrant. I want to say that's what
it had been 88 or 89.
It definitely was in 88. So it could be 89 or 90. So that was like, yeah, but that was like by that point, the same costume designer is designing clothes for every band. Every video looks the same. It didn't matter how great of a musician you were, how talented you, it didn't matter. You were lumped into that scene, and that scene's on its way out. So, but that was like, yeah. LA Guns' first album came out in January of 1988.
Right.
And they barely snuck in, barely. Mm-hmm. Of getting in under the wire of that scene. I mean, really look who came out of that scene, who really made it big. I mean, I'm talking about on a radio level, global level, you know, there's Motley Crue, Rat, you know, that was, I mean, Poison got very big. Mm-hmm. But I mean, everybody else was kind of like underneath here, you know what I mean? And Bon Jovi was one of the biggest artists of the 80s, but he's from New Jersey.
Right.
You know, Def Leppard, one of the greatest rock bands of the 80s, England. So, you know, but the LA bands, it was Motley and Rat and Poison, really, and Guns N' Roses. I mean, Guns N' Roses eclipsed all of those bands. Guns N' Roses is bigger than all of those bands put together. It's really, you know, if you saw Guns N' Roses from those years, the first time I ever saw LA Guns, the last song of the set, Axl Rose jumps up on stage and sings with LA Guns, with him and Phil.
Nice.
So when you saw all from those days, all through the Appetite for Destruction, I saw Guns N' Roses a bunch of times, saw them go get huge. Then they put out the Use Your Illusion albums. Ooh. And I went to a bunch of those shows, and it got so big and so out of control, and Axl was so nutty that it ruined everything. The fame was so big. When you sell 25 million records, the fame is, you know, he's dating models. You know, it's like they lost sight of what Guns N' Roses was. But that first Guns N' Roses album and tour in that whole period, I mean, you don't sell 25 million records because, you know, of marketing hype. You know, that is one of the greatest albums ever made, period. And now, so think about this. That whole first year I'm working for LA Guns, 1988, Guns N' Roses is getting huge. And every interview Tracy Guns did with anybody, they wanted to talk about Guns N' Roses. And it just like drove them crazy. So you're living in the shadow. The Guns in Guns N' Roses is Tracy Guns. It's like, right. So imagine that, trying to compete with that. So it was tough for him. And they always were in the shadow of Guns N' Roses, LA Guns, in that year, you know, at least the year that I was there in 88. But Guns N' Roses was like, you know, there was only a few huge records like that. It was Guns N' Roses, Appetite, Bon Jovi, Slippery When Wet, mm-hmm. Def Leppard, Hysteria.
Right.
Those were the hugest selling records of the rock metal genre in the 80s. But Guns N' Roses was, but again, that album came out in 87, Appetite for Destruction. I mean, I went to see them on this reunion. Actually, it's funny. I saw them on one of the reunion shows in Charlotte. It was like, when you saw the real deal, it's tough to go look at that.
Yeah. You've seen a lot of things, sir. I love to hear, you know, I love to hear what people had to say. Well, what made you decide to write a book?
Well, you know, it's funny. All the things that happened in my life or I've done, I never intended to do most of them. It just kind of happened. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, the situation you were in, you probably didn't have a whole lot of control over a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anything I've done in music always started from being a DJ in a nightclub. Honestly, that's where it all started. Right. But the book, I was over COVID and the pandemic. No one was working. Everything was locked down. And I just started pulling out all my old notes and journals. And I had written some short stories, and I pulled all my papers out and started putting them together on the laptop. And then I decided to write a book. I'm like, I'll just make a book about my life in music and how I started and how I got to where I got and how it ended. And just, you know, it's not a definitive history of anything other than my life and in what I did in music or how I viewed things, you know, my perception of an incident, you know. It's funny, you know, when you do stuff like this, or you've experienced stuff like this, and then you see somebody else write about a story that happened, and you were there, and you're like, that's not what happened. You know, it's like, so I always tell the story of LA Guns opened for Iron Maiden back in 88. Guns N' Roses was opening for Iron Maiden, and they hated it because they were getting really big. It was two nights, Iron Maiden and Guns N' Roses at Irvine Meadows Amphitheater out in Southern California. Two nights sold out. But a lot of those tickets were sold because of Guns N' Roses. Right. So they were getting really big. They didn't want to be on that tour. So they say, you know, Axl's got a voice problem, whatever. So the promoter's freaking out because he knows a lot of people bought tickets because of Guns N' Roses. Iron Maiden wasn't very, they were kind of like on the decline at that point. So they says, well, what's the next best thing? We'll get LA Guns. So we're on tour and playing a club in Florida somewhere, and we get a call. Look, Guns N' Roses dropped off the Maiden tour. You got to get out here right away and get on this tour. Okay. So we had a, we left our truck with all the equipment, everything in Florida. The guy was going to drive from Florida to California with the truck. So all the band guys had were their guitars and stuff. They didn't have any amps or equipment or drums or anything. So we fly to LA, we get there, we land. The next morning, we have to go out to the concert. We had no gear. So we rented gear from SIR, big rental place out in California that people rent, you know, studio instrument rentals. You rent anything, equipment. So it was last minute and they didn't have their great gear in. So they gave us whatever they had and it was not working well. So LA Guns plays the show and everything's cutting out and amps are going out and it was just a mess. So the promoter in his genius had said, we're going to, and he announced this on the radio. We're going to have Guns N' Roses come jam with LA Guns. You know, Axl's voice is shot. So it'll be the other four guys and they're going to come jam with LA Guns to appease the people that bought tickets for Guns N' Roses. So that was not a good idea because there's always tension between Tracy and Slash and sometimes Axl. So anyway, so we do the shit, our set and the equipment's cutting out and then Guns N' Roses comes out to jam and all the amps are going down and all this stuff. So after the show, Slash is freaking out, accusing Tracy of sabotaging their Guns N' Roses, the jam. So, and I'm like, listen, we rented this gear from SIR. We just flew in here, you know, 12 hours ago. Like we, the gear was going down for our set as well as the jam. We didn't do this on purpose, bullshit. Listen, it was a huge scene. So then I read Slash's book and he talks about that incident, how Tracy sabotaged him. And he said, that was the last straw for me and Tracy Guns. And I'm like, so this, when you know what really happened,
right? Yeah,
and
yeah.
then you read this, and then that's how that story now, because Slash wrote it in his book, becomes, you know, in the history books. Like that's what happened there.
It's the gospel truth.
So you know, so there's so many stories in the Naked City, as they say. You know, it's like, but that's what happened there. So I just, with my book, it's like these are my stories, how I see it. Now somebody might come along and go, that's not what happened. Well, that's how I remember it. Well, that's how I was involved in it. Anything I'm talking about, I was there. You know what I mean? It's not like I'm talking about, I was, hell, it was my story. So that's what that book is about. It's really like a memoir of my time working in the music business, mostly in the 80s.
You had a, like I say, you've done so many things, and you know, you've had a life that a lot of people would, maybe you don't think that now, but you have a life that a lot of people would find or do find very interesting. And you know, I think it's great that you, on your Instagram page, that you put pictures and you put stories, because you, I mean, like you said, it's like you said, you were there, you know, and there's young people that are interested in that whole scene and just anything anybody will, you know, any story anybody will tell them.
Yeah, you know, there's so much of it out there on YouTube and everything, and there's a million channels, and there's certain people that do it as like a, as actually a business for themselves. Mm-hmm. And they produce tons of content, and it's the same old stories about, you know, Gene Simmons calls Ace Frehley a drunk, you know, whatever. Right. It's like the same rehashed stories.
Right.
And so much of it has just been, the truth has been stretched and twisted. And it's like, what is this guy talking about? Like, you know, so it's like, I always say, in anything that happens in the news or any cultural shift or whatever it might be, pay attention to the beginning, news or the beginning story, the things that people are reporting the first day or so.
Right.
Because after that, whoever has a vested interest in that story going one way or the other grabs it and twists the narrative and goes somewhere else with it.
They like,
you know, I don't want to get political, but like, you know, I was in New York during 9/11. So I know the initial reports. I know what the fireman was saying. I know all that's been suppressed. After the first few days, it got all suppressed by the media. So, you know, you unless you're there, you don't know what's going on. I see some of these channels and what people report, and I'm like, what is he talking about? Like, you know, like, you know, but again, I'm almost 65 years old. So I was there when it was happening. So I know, even if I wasn't directly there, I know the root genesis of the story.
I like your gold records you got behind you.
Yeah, those are LA Guns records. Those are the only two I have.
That's me. How long have you had? When did you get those? I mean, how long have you had them?
I got those in, it's for the first album in Cocked and Loaded. I think I got those in like the end of 89.
Nice. And is that for selling how many records?
Half a million, 500,000. People, you know, I'll debate this with anybody, but people, you'll read stuff that they had a platinum album with Cocked and Loaded. And I've never seen a platinum Cocked and Loaded album. You know, if it was ever certified platinum, maybe. I've never seen it. I've never seen an actual platinum album. And I've, you know, none of the band members have one that doesn't exist. So, you know, but yes, both of those albums went gold, which at the time, so see, to me, that's an achievement. But at the time, when Bon Jovi's selling 10 million records and Cinderella's selling 3 or 4 million records and Def Leppard's selling 2 or 3 or 4 million records, selling gold was like, okay, what else you got? You know, I mean, it was like whereas in the 70s, having a gold album was a big deal. There were the first really huge selling records that started the whole thing were basically Fleetwood Mac Rumors and Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. Those two sold, you know, mega, mega, mega millions. Before that, and that's 76, we're talking 76, 77. Before that, bands went gold. You know, Led Zeppelin would get a gold album. Kiss would get a gold album. It was a big achievement. But by the 80s, everything was so out of whack. A gold album was like, you know, where's the platinum album? So, but anyway, yes, those are gold albums. The cool thing about those is that you have the album, the cassette, and the CD.
Right.
Shortly after this, that went away. And when you had a gold or platinum record, it just had a cassette and a CD because vinyl went away.
Oh,
then
right.
The cassette went away. Yeah. And then it was just a CD in a little frame this big. It just didn't look the same. So this has all three, which is pretty cool. Great. But
yeah, that's great.
Yeah. You know, I didn't get paid very well. So there you go. That's what I have to show is the two gold records.
You might not have got paid well, but I mean, you met some interesting people. You have an interesting life, and you have a lot of good stories to tell people. And you know, you're exactly right. If people don't write stuff down, you know, and nobody knows anything about you, Mike, the stories you have go with you. They die with you. And, you know, my papa always told me stories. My dad told me stories. I told my own child stories that were handed down to me. And, you know, and it's good that you wrote them down in a book. There's a lot of people that write books. I have quite a few books from artists from the 80s, you know, and it's a good read. I enjoy reading it and just finding out whatever they, you know, want to put in there. Something I discovered that I didn't know, but, you know, good for you for, you know, taking your thoughts and writing them down in a book. And, you know, what keeps you busy these days?
Well, I'm always writing. I'm always working on different projects. I'm writing a couple of things. I'm working on a couple of new things. One of them, actually, I've been working on for a long time. I live off the grid, and I'm very remote out here in New Mexico. And there's, you know, there's always something to do when you live off the grid, you know, solar panels, water well, you know, the only thing that ties me to the grid is the propane tank, you know. So, but it's just, I do a lot of writing, and just I'm out here because I want to be chill. You know what I mean? I've lived all over this country, man, from North Carolina to Georgia, New York, Florida, California. I've lived all over the place. So I chose this spot because it's, there's nothing to do out here, but center yourself. And you know, so it's just a different existence, which most people, I mean, I have to drive like an hour to go to the grocery store. So most people couldn't live like that. You know what I mean? For me, it's perfect because I grew up on a bar stool, man. I mean, from, you know, from the time I was 17, I was just in that life. And it's, you know, I'm sober, don't drink alcohol. So, you know, that changed my life too. I mean, you know, once you don't drink anymore, it's, you have to really face reality and face life. And it's, it, most people can't do it. That's why they drink. And I'm not, look, I'm not preaching to people, but I'm just saying, for me, I spent, you know, good, you know, 20 years drinking and drugging. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to survive it, my younger brother didn't survive it. If you're lucky enough to survive it, I feel there's a reason why you're still here. And if you choose to better yourself, I'm going on 3 years, no alcohol. I mean, not that it was a huge problem over the last 10 years, but you know, a couple of beers every night, you get to be 65, it's not good for you anymore. At least for me. So, you know, you just, life is all about changing and becoming better. And, you know, yes, try to pass it along to your kids. Or, you know, I always say, you know, to young people, question everything, man. Question everything. Don't be an asshole about it, but question everything. In other words, well, that's what they said on TV. Well, how do you know it's true? Well, the government said that. Well, why would they lie? Well, you got to question stuff, or you'll just be force fed and you'll be like a robot. So that's what people need to do, is open their eyes and question things, whatever it might be, and you know, try to live a better life and do the right thing, man. It's one day at a time. That's all you can do.
Well, Mike, it's been fun. I really enjoy, you know, I know last week I had to postpone it, but I really did enjoy talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you. It's fun to hear, you know, stories from, in my opinion, the best era of music. If you guys want a good read, please buy Tales from the Gutter. It's a great read. It's a good one of those. Just sit down, and once I started reading it, I got hooked on it and kept reading it. If you want to hear some great stories from back in the day, some great LA gun stories, road stories, buy Mike's book. And Mike, it was a pleasure talking to you, and I do appreciate it. And, you know, God bless you, and let's stay in touch if we can. How's that?
Sounds good to me, man. I appreciate you having me on. Anytime you make time, I'll pop back on there. And God bless you and your family. Be well, be safe. And the songs never die.
That's exactly right. They're always in here and in here. So
absolutely.